The Helly Kesser Jane Show airs Wednesdays, 3 p.m. Eastern. The podcast's always available online at HellyKesserJane.com.
Okay, you say that love is selfish.
Yes.
Why?
Because selfish means, is this something that benefits you? Is this something that furthers your life? And clearly, finding somebody who shares some basic values with you, whatever they are, gives you a profound enjoyment.
Me, the me generation, the I word, as in I, as in the N word, narcissism, a world gone vain, egotistical, self-centered, narcissistic, selfish, or maybe not enough of any of those. Today on the Helly Kesser Jane Show, joining me at my table are the authors of two books who turn conventional notions on their heads. Up first, Peter Schwartz, the author of In Defense of Selfishness. And in our second half hour, Dr. Craig Malkin, author of Rethinking Narcissism. Hi, and welcome to the Helly Kesser Jane Show. I am Helly Kesser Jane. Today, the Helly Kesser Jane Show is brought to you by Audible.com, a leading provider of spoken audio information and entertainment. Get a free audiobook and 30-day trial today by signing up at www.audibletrial.com/The Helly Kesser Jane Show. And remember, The Helly Kesser Jane Show is always available online at HellyKesserJane.com and a host of venues, including iHeartRadio, Stitcher.com, Spreaker.com, TuneIn Radio, iTunes, and Blog Talk Radio. According to Peter Schwartz, the author of a provocative new book, In Defense of Selfishness, Why the Code of Self-Sacrifice is Unjust and Destructive, every civilized culture is largely defined by a collective view of right and wrong. Schwartz asserts that while the means of how this morality is actually implemented can spark endless controversy, each and every culture holds fast to some fundamental ethical principle. And for our culture, that principle is altruism. Whether we actively practice self-sacrifice on a regular basis, comply grudgingly, or don't subscribe to it at all, we generally consider this altruist code to be correct. But what if we're wrong? What if altruism is in fact at the heart of the social conflicts that plague us today? Peter Schwartz is a retired chairman of the board of directors and currently a distinguished fellow of the Ayn Rand Institute. He is the founding editor and publisher of The Intellectual Activist. Let's talk.
So, Peter, In Defense of Selfishness, Why the Code of Self-Sacrifice is Unjust and Destructive. Now, you sure know how to write a title, so let me applaud you. That's a great title.
Well, thank you.
You're welcome. But do I agree with you? Well, let's wait and see.
Not yet.
I know. Well, yeah, exactly. We'll have to wait to see how that goes. But let's start with some definitions. I really think we need to do this. First, the definition of selfish. I looked it up in a number of dictionaries, and they all define selfish pretty much the same way as a person, action, or motive lacking consideration for others, concerned chiefly with one's own personal profit or pleasure, with synonyms that include egocentric, egotistic, egotistical, self-centered, self-absorbed, wrapped up in oneself. Here's another one. Inconsiderate, thoughtless, unthinking, uncaring. And, you know, I even went to the Urban Dictionary because I was curious to see what they would say. And, of course, they were succinct. When you have a huge amount of interest invested in yourself or when you don't think about the want and needs of others. So here's my question. You find this defensible? Because I'm not sure there's anything more maddening, by the way, than a truly selfish person. Talk to me.
Well, this is the crucial issue. The question is, what is meant by selfishness? And most people have this idea. If you ask them, what do you associate with the idea of selfishness, they would say, well, it means somebody who's this kind of amoral predator, victimizes others, someone like Bernie Madoff, Attila the Hun. They live off the blood of others. That is the common view of selfishness. And in my view, these kinds of people, these are parasites. are actually acting contrary to their long-term self-interest. They are acting self-destructively. I think selfishness involves acting for your own benefit without victimizing others. The truly selfish person is somebody who lives an honest, productive, self-respecting life, and he deals with other people by exchange, by offering them value for value to mutual benefit. He doesn't sacrifice himself to others, and he doesn't ask others to sacrifice for him.
Okay, that sounds very succinct, and it also sounds somewhat cold, more business-like than what, fraternal even. So you did mention Bernie Madoff, and I'm going to mention Wall Street vultures. These are poster children for selfishness, and I'm not sure that I understand the difference between those people and holy selfish people.
Okay, well, I wouldn't call them holy, but the consistently selfish people, the difference is essentially this. Do you live your life by your own effort, by what you've produced, by your own mind, by your own work, or do you feed off others? Do you victimize others? Do you lie and cheat and steal and kill and be parasitic off the work of other people? The latter is not selfish. The former, the person who genuinely lives by his own work, by his own effort, not sacrificing others for his sake, that is what selfishness really means.
Okay. The opposite, let's go there.
Okay.
Is altruism.
Yes.
Okay. Defined as unselfish regard for or devotion to the welfare of others, which for you would come under the heading of self-sacrifice, and I think you even call it servitude in the book.
Yes.
So there's no virtue in altruism? It's subordination even when it's a choice? What?
Yes, even if it's a choice. If you understand what altruism is, now here too, there's kind of a package deal involving altruism. A lot of people think altruism means loving others, being friends, acting benevolently, helping an old lady across the street. Now, that is not altruism because that is perfectly compatible with your self-interest. What altruism really demands of you is that you subordinate your life to someone else's, that you sacrifice for them. In other words, if somebody lacks something that you have, you are morally obligated to sacrifice for them. The needs of others should come before yourself. That is the meaning of altruism. And that's why I call it servitude, because altruism says you exist. The moral justification of your life is not what you've done for yourself, but how much you've served the needs of others.
Can you not give to others without subordinating yourself?
Oh, yes, absolutely. Now, I'm not opposed to charity, for example, and I give to certain charities. If you see somebody who's an innocent victim of some misfortune through no fault of his own, and you decide, you know, he deserves your help, and you can afford to do so, that's fine. That's not a problem. The problem is when the problem is the premise that you have a moral duty to do so. A problem is when the person in need is regarded as entitled, morally entitled to your help and to your sacrifices. Because according to altruism, whatever you have, if somebody has less, you are obligated to sacrifice for him. You have to put his needs before yours. That's why I regard self-sacrifice as destructive and unjust, because it makes you into a servant of somebody else.
Before I go into that even deeper, and I think we will as we go along, I want to, and before we bring Ayn Rand, I think she belongs in this conversation to some degree because there are historical roots to all of this conversation. Your assertion that the problem is of increasing social conflict is the result, not the absence of altruism in our lives, but its overwhelming presence. That's an extraordinary statement in and of itself. Isn't that the
yes.
Tag on your book? Talk to me about that.
Well, here's the issue.
Okay.
Look at society today, where everybody agrees there's something really wrong. There's constant conflict. Altruism supposedly is the road to social harmony, but look at what it's actually accomplished. Every time you earn a dollar, the government comes to you, for example, and says, you've got to pay to subsidize somebody else's mortgage. You've got to pay to subsidize somebody else's health. You've got to pay for to send foreign aid to the people in Bangladesh. That means there's a constant conflict between your needs and someone else's, between your life and others. According to altruism, there is no way ever to resolve that. You constantly have to give and give and give more. Now, in my view, that's wrong. That is a prescription for perpetual social conflict. The proper way for people to live in harmony is for each to understand that they're equals, that you are not a servant to someone else, and he doesn't have to be a servant to you. How do you deal with each other? other then? By exchanging value for value. You have something he wants, he has something you want. You cooperate, you deal harmoniously where it's to mutual benefit as against the idea that one person's gain has to come at someone else's loss.
Well, maybe one person's gain doesn't have to come at one other person's loss, and maybe there isn't always an equal framework. Maybe all people aren't created equal, and do we not have a responsibility to other people who, you know, there's a roll of the dice. There are all sorts of reasons that people might need our help.
Yes, as I said, if you decide that there's someone who deserves your help and he's an innocent victim, wasn't his fault, which is not the case with many of the situations we're called upon to help out. But if you decide, yes, the person genuinely is in need, no fault of his own. I mean, if you see some orphan, you know, on the streets, obviously you'd say, okay, if I can help him out, I'd be glad to. There's just a genuine benevolence and goodwill appropriate between people. But that's between people who are equal in the sense of each is entitled to his own life. Whereas if you operate on the idea that you're really not entitled to your own life, you're entitled to only to give what you have to someone who has less, then everyone who has less it creates a moral claim against you. There's no a servant. Take actual slavery. A slave who serves his master is not engaging in benevolence, is not engaging in goodwill. But what altruism says, in effect, not literally, but in a philosophic sense, is that you are the slave of someone else, because as long as he has needs that he can't fulfill and you can, you're morally obligated to do it. And in our society, in our political system, the government sets up a whole social structure whereby we have laws that coerce you into doing that. The money is taken from you to be redistributed to others. So altruism is the underlying idea behind the whole welfare state that we've implemented.
Okay, so I'm starting to get this a little bit from where you're coming from. You're really objecting to imposed altruism.
No. I'm saying that imposed altruism is the logical consequence, the inevitable consequence of, quote, voluntary altruism. But remember, altruism does not mean simply helping others or charity. Altruism means sacrificing. You have to harm yourself in order to help others. You have to regard someone else's life as more important than your own. That is the doctrine of altruism. And that's what I object to.
Ayn Rand. How old were you when you got into Ayn Rand?
I first read her, my late teens, I think 17, 18, 19. And I read her novel, Atlas Shrugged, and was very taken by it, and gradually decided to think about her ideas and decide whether they're true or not. And I decided that they are. And that's why this book and other things I've written are essentially based on her philosophy of objectivism. And if I can just take a second to, since you brought her up, her philosophy is that reason, man is a rational animal, and reason is the way that he survives, and reason is his primary good, it's his primary value. And people should deal with each other by voluntary means, not by coercion. And the proper ethical system is pursuing one's rational self-interest.
Okay, so Ayn Rand and you. And your whole life apparently has now been devoted. You were the president, right, of the Institute?
No, I was the chairman of the board.
Chairman of the board, and now you serve as?
A distinguished fellow.
Okay, all right. So let's look at what you just said also about this rational self-interest, a genuine selfishness. Peter, who defines what's rational and who says what's genuine? And right versus wrong has to meet some parameter. And who is to say what those parameters are? I mean, generally our moral compass has been to follow the code of religion, Judeo-Christian culture, if you will.
Yes.
Talk to me about that.
Well, if you ask who decides what is right, the ultimate answer is reality. Each individual has to use his own judgment to decide what's true and what's false, what's right and what's wrong. Who decides that, you know, 2 and 2 are 4, or who decides that you've got to eat nutritious food rather than dirt? You decide. You look at the facts of reality and come to a certain conclusion. Now, religion is the opposite. Religion commands certain things based not on evidence, on facts, on reason, but on blind faith. Religion says, do whatever God tells you. Why? Because God tells you. God knows better than you. you. Now, that means you're supposed to give up your mind, give up your rational judgment, and just blindly obey in defiance of reason. Accept something even if you have evidence against it simply because God says so. And that is not a prescription for a proper moral code for human beings.
You have a problem with religion or faith?
Yes, I'm afraid I do.
Okay.
Yes, faith just means give up your mind. You know, believe what somebody tells you. Now, if somebody is God or God's spokesman or people claiming to be God's spokesman or claiming to be some other God's spokesman, and you just arbitrarily choose, I'm going to obey. Now, I think that's a very denigrating view of human nature. Man is able to survive by his own mind. You have a brain. You have judgment. You're not an animal. You don't live by whatever you're instinctively programmed to do. You come to certain conclusions, and the distinctiveness of human beings as against animals is that we are rational beings. And rational means using your mind to decide what's right and what's wrong, not blindly obeying some spokesman for some divine revelation.
Okay, so spirituality.
Oh, well, you know, that's a good point, because many people think that this philosophy, particularly Ayn Rand's philosophy, my philosophy, is a crude materialism, and, you know, all that matters is make as much money as you can and, you know, hoard everything. And now, that is a really terrible injustice, because spiritual values are values too. You want to live a certain kind of life. You want to follow certain moral principles. I think things like honesty and integrity and justice are proper moral principles, because ultimately they are in your self-interest. Love, for example, is a tremendously important value. It's a spiritual value. You don't love somebody because of the cash, you know, in his or her pocket, or how rich he or she can make you. You love a person for the value that person brings to you. You're happy to be in a relationship with that person, and it is a supremely selfish personal value. So there's no dichotomy between material values and spiritual values. Both are in your self-interest.
Okay, you say that love is selfish.
Yes.
Why?
Because selfish means, is this something that benefits you? Is this something that furthers your life? And clearly, finding somebody who shares some basic values with you, whatever they are, gives you a profound enjoyment, profound pleasure. Imagine the opposite. Imagine love that's unselfish, a selfless love. That would be, pick somebody at random off the street and say, you know, I'm going to love you, I'm going to marry you, but I'm going to give you my love as charity. I don't particularly care for you. You have nothing in common with me. You're of no value to me. But as charity, I'm going to dispense love to you. That's what a selfless love is. A proper love or friendship or any positive human relationship is based on the fact that there are spiritual values that people share and that benefit both parties in a relationship.
All pleasure is selfish?
Well, yes. If it's a rational pleasure, not a mindless pleasure for the short term that destroys you in the long term. You know, maybe people get pleasure shooting up cocaine, but it's ultimately destructive. It destroys they have a pleasure today at the cost of destroying their lives forever in the future. That is not selfish. Selfish is the long term.
Let's bring laissez-faire capitalism into this, the separation of the economy and the state. Talk about me about the about laissez-faire capitalism and libertarianism.
Let's separate the two for a minute, okay?
Okay.
Because I'm in favor of capitalism, which means not the system we have today in America, which is half free and half controlled. I mean a system of full laissez-faire capitalism where individuals are free to deal with one another voluntarily. They can't use force. They can't use fraud. If they do, the government has to step in. But as long as they're acting voluntarily and both parties or all parties involved agree to a certain transaction, agree to certain, cooperate in a certain activity, the government has no role whatsoever. It can't tell you, you know, what to charge for your product or who to sell it to or when to sell it or to close your stores on Sunday. None of that is the government's business. That is laissez-faire capitalism. Now, that answers your question about capitalism?
Well, I suspect that it does. I was speaking to it more in terms of why you feel that they totally need to be separated, because I think that there are times when they can't be. Like, let me throw this back at you. Sure. There's no place for government. Here's something you said. There's no place for government in education, medicine, agriculture, housing, energy, or any idea of life in which people deal with one voluntarily. voluntarily. But so let me bring it to this in terms of what we've just established here, and that is the collective. And I'm curious about this. A United States of America, right, made up of more or less, quote unquote, united people who at its nexus must function sometimes for the sacrifice for the greater good. Is there only individualism?
Yes, I don't think that sacrificing some people for the benefit of other people benefits a society as a whole either. I think that if you have, cannibalism is not a productive way for people to live. If you have a majority that decides to sacrifice the minority, if you have two people, let's take two of your two neighbors come to you and say, you know, we two have decided to expropriate your house because it's going to benefit two of us and harm only one of you. Now, that is not in the interest of anybody, because in the long term, you just disintegrate into a society of gang warfare. The proper way for society to benefit is by recognizing that each individual in that society has a right to his own life, and that you can't violate that right no matter how many people supposedly benefit. I don't think sacrificing one person for another or one person for many others serves anyone's interest in the long term. The one thing that does serve everyone's interest, the one thing that is actually in the public good, is individual freedom. Leave everyone free, then everyone benefits ultimately, as long as they deal with each other by voluntary means rather than by coercive or fraudulent.
Is there any place for government?
Yes, absolutely. This is where I part company with libertarianism. There's a strong role for government, a necessity for government to protect us when our rights are threatened. So you need government to protect you against criminals, for example. You need government to run courts, the court system, to adjudicate conflicts among people that can't be resolved voluntarily. And you need the government to protect you against foreign invaders. In other words, any time there's a threat of force against you, because force is the only way your rights can be violated, anytime there is such a threat, the government has to step in strongly and resolutely and repel that force, including force being threatened by foreign bodies, such as, the Islamic totalitarians today. That's the role of government, but no more.
But Peter, if you acknowledge that, aren't you acknowledging that there is a collective?
Why, no. I don't know what you mean by is a collective.
By a collective, I mean that there are all of us,
right,
and we, in one way or another, together need to be protected.
Yes, the collective consists of each individual who makes up that society, and each individual retains his own rights to his own life and his own pursuit of happiness as long as he doesn't try to impose it on others. Then you have a harmony of interests among people. If people accept the idea that I can't put a gun to my neighbor's head and force him to give me money just because I need it, and he can't do it to me, then you don't have conflicts between one person and another. Whereas if you say, yes, some people can use force in order to advance what they think is the good of others, then you have perpetual conflict, and you have the kind of society that we have today where everybody is at everybody else's throat.
Freedom is a very funny thing in many ways. Funny, serious, but funny, I mean, I'm being cynical maybe. And there's the definition of what freedom is. But is freedom not something that really is not fully attainable, but rather something that we strive for as a true destination? I mean, who of us is truly free, including you?
It depends on how you define freedom here, because if you define freedom as something vague like getting anything you wish, well, then obviously you're not free. But that is a non-concept. That there's no basis in reality for such a thing. What there is a basis for is the political idea of freedom, which means that no one is using force against you, that your life, you're free to live your life according to the best of your abilities and the best of your judgment. Whatever your talents are, you rise as far as your abilities take you. Whether you're rich or poor, you are free to pursue your own values and your own goals without coercive interference by others. And that means without interference by other private individuals or without interference by the government. If that's how you define freedom, then now we're not free in our society today because, as I said, we're a mixture of the semi semi-free and semi-controlled, but you could be free if the government accepted the idea that you have a right to your own existence and can't be sacrificed for the sake of others.
You know, we're living in odd times. I don't have to tell you that. Crazy things are happening. On the one hand, the government seems to be wanting to take over on a whole lot of places. It probably has no business doing that. And in others, it seems to be relinquishing some of its powers. You call it the paternalistic nanny state, which is apt, I think, on that. You and I totally agree. It inserts itself in places that you just kind of roll your eyes and say, why would anybody put up with this? Like if you're dying of cancer, the FDA telling you that you can't try drugs that it's your choice. Or if I'm in pain and I want to kill myself, that's my choice. Why? You know, there I'm with you 100%. I mean, to me, it's just utterly bizarre. But that is changing. And the times are changing in some ways, yes?
Well, you mean changing for the better or the worse?
Well, I think that in some ways, and as I started this, I said in some ways things are better, in some ways things are worse. I do think, though, that we're seeing changes in what people, maybe that's the better way to say it, are no longer willing to put up with from the government.
Well, you know what happens is that these things go, they're blips. You know, it goes up and down because the government will just often overreach and do something so crazy, you know, like trying to, you know, in New York City when they try to ban those large bottles of large cups of sugared soda. I mean, there was just an outrage. So what happens is the government just goes too far sometimes, and then there's a reaction, and then it pulls back a tiny bit. And then in 10 or 20 years, the thing that seems so bizarre 20 years ago now is commonly accepted. And that happens all the time. Our trend, unfortunately, is in the direction of more and more government control. And this has been happening for, I think, over 100 years. And the paternalistic activities of government, including what you mentioned, where the FDA says it's in the, quote, public interest that we decide exactly which drugs you may or may not take, and we can't simply make an exception for you because you decide this drug is good for you, or you and your doctor do, or you're dying and you have no other choice. We can't make an exception for the individual because the individual doesn't matter on this philosophy. All that matters is the, quote, collective. And the FDA says we represent the public good. We can't therefore take into consideration what actually benefits real existing individual people.
At the end of the day, you know what I wonder?
What?
First of all, I think that everybody, no matter how you want to define freedom, cries for freedom. I think that's innate in who we are. How we get there, how we don't, how we stand in our own way. Maybe we're selfish, maybe we're not, maybe we're altruistic, maybe we're not. You know, the bottom line is I think people want to control their own lives and to have everything that they ever want. Hear me out on this. So sure. I'm wondering in some ways that we define these things and we give them names, totalitarianism, libertarianism, you know, laissez-faire. I mean, is it not semantics in a way? Is it not a function of trying to find the way that works for us?
If only that were true. If only people genuinely wanted to be free and just differed on how to get there. The fact is, and the problem is, that people have very different philosophies. They have very different ideas of what constitutes the good. They have very different ideas of what is right and wrong. So it's bizarre, I think, and I don't think you would argue, would you, that some entities like ISIS they really only want freedom. They want every individual to be happy, but they think the way to do it is by beheading everybody who doesn't agree with them.
No, I don't think that's what they want. Let me stop you because I don't agree with that's what they want. I don't think it's about freedom.
Okay, well, that's my point, that freedom is not a universal value. There are many people who don't want freedom. And even in the United States, I don't want to use just the extreme example of these Islamic jihadists. Even in the United States, when we have this, for example, a paternalistic state, when an FDA official looks you in the face and says, I know you're dying of cancer, but we can't allow individual concerns to override the collective standard by which we make our decision. Do you think that they really believe that that freedom is a value? They think government control is a value. That's a different value. They think the proper way for people to live is for somebody to give the orders and everybody to obey.
Well, I think that's what you're talking about.
Dictators do. There are many dictatorships in the world.
Well, you're talking about some people's goal is power.
Power, yes. There,
and
that
control.
That's true.
Right. And I hear that. But I'm saying, you know, look, we could talk for 2 hours on this one. We go down every rat hole that there is to go, and I would be happy to do it with you anytime you want. We don't have time today. But my point being this, that maybe there's a larger argument for a fair and balanced implementation of a, I'm going to, for lack of a better word, a moral code that serves both the individual and the collective. And I suggest that to assert that one is, I don't know, somehow better than the other injects its own limitation to the very freedom that is the goal. That's all I'm trying to say.
Yes, I think I agree with that, but my view is there is no conflict between what benefits the individual and what benefits society. I think when you try to set up the idea that the individual has to be sacrificed for society, that's when you set up the conflict, and that's an irresolvable one. I think that if you grant people the right to live their own lives and not to be coerced, no matter how much alleged benefit other people might derive from it, then you have a harmony of interest and people live peacefully and cooperatively and you get a productive, prosperous society.
I've been speaking with Peter Schwartz, author of In Defense of Selfishness, Why the Code of Self-Sacrifice is Unjust and Destructive, by way of Palgrave Macmillan. For more information on Peter Schwartz and his book, visit his website at peterschwartz.com. In his eye-opening new book, Rethinking Narcissism, The Bad and Surprising Good About Feeling Special, Dr. Craig Malkin, clinical psychologist and instructor of psychology for Harvard Medical School, offers a radically new model for understanding what he asserts is an often misused term. Narcissism, argues Dr. Malkin, is essentially a spectrum of self-importance, and everyone falls somewhere on the scale between utter selflessness and total arrogance. With 2 decades of experience helping individuals, couples, and families, his articles, advice, and insights have appeared in Psychology Today, Marie Claire, Women's and Men's Health magazines, Huffington Post, and more. He's been a featured commentator on NPR and Fox News. Let's talk. So, my friend, having come from a long line of narcissists and no doubt being one myself, good luck with you, sir, when talking to me in this conversation, Dr. Malkin. But seriously, I couldn't wait to speak to you about this. This is groundbreaking material as far as I'm concerned. Rethinking Narcissism, The Bad and Surprisingly Good About Feeling Special. Define narcissism as most of us understand it.
Just to clarify, it's actually Rethinking Narcissism, The Bad and Surprising Good About Feeling Special.
Oh, okay. I'm glad that you got that correct. Talk to me.
And so define narcissism.
Mm-hmm.
So one thing I want to get out of the way up front is that people can learn all about my perspective and the research. If you go to the narcissismtest.com, you can actually take the test online, a brief version of the research tool that we developed. And you can see how high or low you are in narcissism and get research back tips and feedback. And people love it. At last count, something like 38,000 people had taken it so far. But what we traditionally think of as narcissism, what comes to mind for most of us, and when we think of narcissists, is sort of the vain, boastful reality TV type, chest-thumping braggarts. But the reality is that there are many types of narcissists, and there's lots of types of narcissism. You get too focused on that version of it, you're not going to understand the common core of what drives all narcissists. And what's interesting is what we discovered is if you look at the research, it appears that a part of it is a normal, pervasive human drive, the drive to feel special. That is how I define narcissism. And as soon as you define it that way, all kinds of things become clearer that were not clear before, including it's a lot easier to identify more subtle narcissists and protect yourself when necessary. You just think of this as a normal drive that's gone out of control. Narcissists are addicted to feeling special.
Addicted to feeling special. That's a fascinating way to put it. It's a term that is tossed around, however. And so on the larger spectrum of it all, we all have this broad definition, and it has a negative connotation. And the comma after your main title on the book is the bad and surprising good about feeling special.
Yes. Yeah. And it could have actually been called the surprising bad and surprising good, but that's a dreadful title. So, because again, this is the chief rethink. It really helps people recognize problems more easily. But let's get to the surprising good, because it's all part of coping. So over a quarter century of research shows that most people around the world feel a little bit special. They see themselves through slightly rose-colored glasses, and that helps them feel more optimistic, resilient, and persist in the face of failure. It even helps them enjoy big dreams. It helps us give and receive in relationships. It's very helpful for our relationships. So we need that. Again, that appears to be just a part of human experience. It's when people turn away from love and relationships and towards feeling special in all kinds of ways, like for their looks or for their talents or even for being the most misunderstood person in the room, when they become addicted to being special, that's when they become narcissists. But on the other end, it's also clear from the same research that if people don't feel a little of that, see themselves through slightly rose-colored glasses, they suffer. In the research, they become at the extreme what I have dubbed echoists. And that is from the myth of Narcissus and Echo. Echo was the nymph who could only repeat back the last few words that she heard someone say, and she fell in love with Narcissus. And much like Echo in the myth, people who struggle with echoism are afraid of standing out, afraid they don't have their own voice. They're afraid of seeming narcissistic in any way. They've often grown up or been raised by caregivers who are extremely narcissistic, and so they develop the stance towards life. If I want someone to love to be, if I want to feel connected, I have to take up as little room as possible.
That's sad. That's sad. But talk to me about this. Talk to me about, and again, we have to talk in broad terms because of the length of time that we have here, but what causes, quote unquote, bad narcissism?
Oh, well, there seems to be a genetic component.
Okay.
I believe that most personality is 50-50, that nurture and nature. That shows up in the research again and again. You have to have a predisposition towards a certain personality for it to develop, but there's going to be environments that bring it out. So in one huge longitudinal study that was over the course of 20 years, they actually found early precursors of unhealthy narcissism in preschoolers. It was signs like being constant rule breakers, always drawing attention to themselves, showing off, being extremely overdramatic. And when that showed up in preschoolers, they were more likely later on in life to show these signs of unhealthy narcissism. Again, when you're addicted to feeling special, it really means you're setting all other considerations aside, including what other people feel and want and need. But here's the good news. And I have a whole chapter in Rethinking Narcissism. This is part of the big Rethink too. I have a whole chapter devoted to raising healthy, self-confident, caring children, kind of 8 keys for how to do that. Because what the same longitudinal research shows is that if you are responsive, even to kids like these, the ones who felt like their parents were there for them and understood them, talked to them about their feelings, helped soothe them when they were distressed, did not become narcissists later in life. They didn't show unhealthy narcissism. So there's an interaction. You have to have maybe a difficult temperament and then not very responsive parenting.
Neglect.
It can be certainly in the case of neglect and abuse. If somebody's already tending in this direction, they're far more likely to end up at the far end of the narcissism spectrum, where you find narcissists. And narcissist, by the way, is not a diagnosis. It means somebody who's higher in traits than the average person. Disorder is narcissistic personality disorder.
Right. And we're going to talk about that in a minute. But let me go off on a different tangent just for a second here. Yeah. You know that writer Tom Wolfe termed the boomers as the me generation.
Yeah.
And the millennials have been branded the most narcissistic generation ever.
Yes.
So talk to me about this. Are the baby boomers any more narcissistic than their predecessors? Have the millennials broken the bank on selfishness? Or have we as a society, listen to me, lost a moral compass? Is there a moral component to all of this, if you will? A society that is, as a whole, is just stuck on me?
Well, I think there's a problem with people celebrating unhealthy narcissism.
Ah.
I want that to change. Too much attention to reality TV types,
right,
and a model, and people people modeling themselves after them. We've got politicians who are struggling so much with their own narcissism that they can't say sorry for insulting somebody, a war hero or a prisoner of war, no less, just for example.
My goodness.
I mean, there are plenty of examples.
Right, right.
I am not convinced there's a narcissism epidemic. I'm not alone. The research is based on shaky survey studies, largely college students who we already know from other research. They're the ones who tend to be highest in narcissism anyway. And by all accounts, if you look at other studies, that falls after the age of 25. The main thrust of the argument that narcissism is on the rise was based on that survey evidence, with one tool that has come under heavy fire because it might be picking up a fair amount of health. So one researcher actually argued that we should call millennials Generation We, because he found them to be more caring and connected on a larger global scale to the large community than any other previous generation. So he suggested not using that at all. That what was supposed to be the nail in the coffin for the poor millennials was that narcissistic personality disorder had seemed to rise from 1% to 6% in a large-scale study. That turned out to be wrong.
Okay.
It's still widely cited that the rate of NPD is 6%, and it is not. It turned out that that came about because the study was done by census workers collecting the information, and they found everybody was high on everything. There was too much OCD and too much depression, and there was too much everything. And so another group of psychologists came along and said, well, let's actually restrict this to people who are really unhealthy, and we wound up with the 1% again.
I'm going to go back to that in 1 second. Travel down this road with me. So you say that everyone falls somewhere on the spectrum of self-importance, and everyone falls somewhere on the scale between utter selflessness and total arrogance. You think that we're too focused on the outer edge of spectrums as a society these days? Do you know where I'm going? You understand that?
On both the lack of the healthy narcissism, that ability that I talk about in rethinking narcissism to see yourself for rose-colored glasses a little bit, and also narcissists. Is that what you mean?
Well, you know, we do tend to, we're a society that's driven in isms and oh my gods, and you know, I'm looking for words, hyperbolic about everything, so that when we look at what was always the spectrum that you talk about so brilliantly in the book, but that we're focusing on the edges of that spectrum, so the whole world looks crazy, rather than where you are trying to take us, into the center where we all can find a place, that because it's all a part of us, this narcissism.
I would say that's absolutely true. Yes, we like extreme. We like to see the world in black and white, clear, distinct, either or categories. Either you're a narcissist or you're not. Worse, what we have now today is either you're a pathological narcissist or you're not.
Right.
And that's a problem, because what happens is people get very confused in their relationships when they see subtler signs, and they maybe feel hope where they shouldn't, because they read all the blogs and they read the information out there saying that all narcissists are evil through and through, and they're completely confused. Is because they're not seeing it, even though they might be with somebody who's extremely narcissistic.
It's part of our narcissistic society. Okay, a lot of two C's and S's in there.
Yeah, that's a tough one.
Oh my gosh!
I mentioned for people if they want to take the test that went along with rethinking narcissism, if you do have trouble spelling, just go to drcraigmalkin.com, and there's a tab for the narcissism test.
I can't tell you, I was typing up today how many times I had to use the word thing. On that darn word that drove me crazy. But, you know, it's like, it seems to me that's even part of the narcissistic society that we are today, that we can't see the gray. Yes, right? It's very bizarre.
Well, and it leads to problems. I made a point in one article that I wrote for Huffington Post, where I made the point that everybody is remarkably self-inflated these days about how narcissism-free they are. Ironically.
I don't know. It seems to me, if you are a narcissist,
I don't have any.
No, right. Or you know, there's the other spectrum. That's me. Like, just embrace it. It is who you are, and just go for it, babe. You know, as long as you're not hurting anybody in the process. I want to go back to the NPI, to the Narcissism Personality Inventory. And this is a question that I have. It's the most widely used measure of narcissism in social psychological research, and it's based on the DSM, Clinical Criteria for Narcissistic Personality Disorder. And I want to bring it up in this term, that it seems to me that these days we want to classify everything. I mean, everything. everything is classified. It makes you a little nuts. I got this, I got that, I got, oh my God. Why are we wanting to do that? Why the need to brand? Because that can, in a way, make a self-fulfilling prophecy. I will become a narcissist. Do you know what I'm saying?
Yes, absolutely. I think two reasons. I think we just touched on one, which is that when you are able to brand, and then you can point to it and say, that brand is not me, it can help you feel superior.
Part of narcissism itself. I love it.
Right. It's sort of, I would never be like that. And the reality is, when any of us, I have this one line in Rethinking Narcissism, rage makes narcissists of us all.
Right.
When we feel hurt, when we feel upset, we don't care at all what the other person is feeling. If we're angry enough, we lose all our empathy. So I see this as, again, a part of the rethink is to see this not just as something fixed at either extreme, whether it's too little or too much, but as something that we can slide around on and we can actually get help moving into a healthier place. I think the focus on the immediate branding also makes things simpler for people. They don't have to think about the complexity that's going on with someone, which can be helpful to write. You know, I would not take that away, for example, from the survivor community, many of whom have experienced abuse and have been very badly hurt by extraordinarily narcissistic people I call malignant narcissists. And it helps for them to have, this is just it, this is who these people are, so that they can have some distance and heal. It gets confusing because even the most extreme narcissist has good parts and bad parts, and sometimes you see the good. So I think having a really distinct category can also help us get distance when we need it.
One in two marriages ends in divorce. Does that have a lot to do with who we are and the kind of narcissistic society we are?
That statistic has been around for some time. I'm not, uh-huh. This is again where I'm not convinced. First of all, it's inflated by people who divorce multiple times. A lot of the people in that figure are people who get divorced over and over. I think we've become more apt to move on instead of doing the hard work in relationships. And it often does require hard work to try to reconnect with our partners. I'm a couples therapist.
I know. So that's why I wanted to ask you that question.
I see this all the time. And part of the problem is people get stuck in these interactions and they can't get out because it starts to feel too emotionally risky to do what's needed to change it. Meaning, to be concrete, we have to be able to say, I'm lonely, or I'm sad, I'm scared, you're important to me, and this is really, you know, that's why it hurts and scares me so much, in order to reconnect with our partners. And if we don't feel safe, we can't do that. We should, maybe when we get to NPD, talk about what I call the stop signs.
Talk to me about them now. Talk now.
Okay, well, so what is narcissistic personality disorder? It was almost kicked out of the DSM precisely because of the problems I mentioned earlier that I cover in Rethinking Narcissism, where there's so many different varieties. We have vulnerable narcissists now. We have grandiose, and a term I hate because all narcissists are grandiose. It doesn't make any distinction. Communal narcissists, people who are so... Let's talk about narcissistic personality disorder. It was almost kicked out of the Diagnostic and Statistical Manual. That's the Bible of mental health that's published by the American Psychiatric Association. It was almost kicked out because of all these confusions that there's so many different kinds of narcissism. It gets very difficult and very murky to decide how bad this person is in this area versus another. And then there's the whole problem of that's been around forever, that narcissism itself is not a diagnosis. That's why a classic text on the subject is called Disorders of Narcissism, because we've had all this evidence for an idea of healthy narcissism for some time. So you take narcissists who is that they don't trust they can turn to people and depend on them and expect that they'll hear and comfort them and help them feel good. They don't have the capacity for what's called secure love or secure attachment in the research. So instead of depending on people in any real authentic way, they depend on feeling special instead. That's in all kinds of ways, whether it's by being the most giving person in the room or the most misunderstood person in the room or the most attractive person in the room. There's all kinds of ways to feel special. This is why in Rethinking Narcissism, I wanted to streamline all of this and give it a common core. As soon as the addiction becomes strong enough, now other people's feelings and needs don't matter. All that matters, like anyone who is addicted, narcissists use feeling special like a substance to soothe themselves instead instead of turning to people for love and caring and concern. And like anyone who's addicted, they'll lie, they'll steal, they'll cheat. They'll cheat if they need to feel important. In other words, they'll do things like steal your ideas at work and pass them off as theirs. As soon as you get into that, what I call the three E's, exploitation, severe exploitation of other people to get your needs met and feel special, extreme entitlement, often accompanied by rage when they don't get what they want, and empathy impairment. Those are the core of narcissistic personality disorder. It is pervasive and without help. Again, the rate that I quote in Rethinking Narcissism that shows up in the research again and again is 1% of the population. That 1% doesn't have much hope of getting better without help.
But with help.
But with help, I see people with NPD, narcissistic personality disorder, all the time. I'm through Skype or in my office. These are people who call up and they say, I feel like a monster and I'm ruining my relationships and my life and I want to change. It's that awareness that gives us some hope when the person is not in denial of their problems. Remember, I mean, if you're in denial of having an alcohol problem, you're not going to stop drinking.
Right.
If you're in denial that you're so addicted to feeling special, you can't even consider other people, you're not going to change.
This is an odd thing to say, maybe, in the context of this conversation, but it's a judgment, or one would take it as a judgment to be called a narcissist, to be called, you know, somebody who's diagnosed with the disorder, if you will. That's so without compassion. We have compassion for people who have cancer. We have compassion for people who have other problems. But boy, I'll tell you, that narcissism brings out the worst and the most empathetic, I think. What are your thoughts?
It brings out the worst and the most what?
Empathetic. Even if you are an empathetic person, somehow we don't feel for people who are narcissists. We get nasty about narcissists.
Yes. Well, many extreme narcissists make it very hard. This is not rethinking narcissism. You're probably already, everybody can tell, is not an apology for narcissists. It's an attempt to help people on how to understand and cope, particularly by recognizing what drives it. And we can recognize that very often narcissists, especially people with narcissistic personality disorder, have been abused. They have been neglected. That's clear from the research that there's strong ties between being an abuser as an adult and having been abused when you were younger. We can recognize that there are people out there who've been very hurtful and they've traumatized others in their relationships and feel for the fact that they've become so lost.
Yeah, and I think that's an important point to make. And I wonder about love. If you've been a person who's been without love, who's been neglected, you know, the things that we were talking about that could be the cause of narcissism, that does it work to give love, to help?
The answer is yes for some. Again, so this links to the three stop signs that I outline in Rethinking Narcissism. There are approaches that you can take to find out if there's some hope in the relationship, especially if the other person is actually if the person who's narcissistic is in therapy. But there are three stop signs, which are reasons to find help leaving a relationship. Not everyone with narcissistic personality disorder becomes an abuser, but some do. And if you have experienced physical or emotional abuse is name calling, put downs, being extremely controlling, that's reason to get help leaving. It doesn't matter if it's caused by a drug problem of some kind or narcissism, it's reason to get help leaving. I mentioned the other stop sign, it's denial. If your partner or friend can't even acknowledge and say, I think I'm in trouble here, I think I might need help, that is reason to get help in leaving the relationship. And yet a third sign is extreme psychopathy. Psychopathy is a cold, remorseless approach to relationships where often people who are extremely psychopathic narcissists would not hesitate to embezzle if it would help them feel better. They would not hesitate to have multiple affairs and lie straight to their partner about it. And the chances of things getting better in a relationship with someone who is psychopathically narcissistic or also known as a malignant narcissist are very small.
So you wanted
to get back to when there's the middle ground, when there's some hope. Correct?
Right. I do. Is there hope?
There is hope for some. So as long as you don't see those stop signs, what the research shows is that it isn't by calling people out on how arrogant and nasty they're being that they change. That's not surprising. If somebody tells you you're being a jerk, you're probably going to become more narcissistic. So what I often tell people who are struggling with this in their relationships is if it doesn't work with you, it's not going to work with a narcissist.
Right.
Especially somebody who has narcissistic personality disorder, what seems to be far more effective, because what we're seeing in the research is we used to have this idea that even people with extreme narcissistic personality disorder have zero empathy. That was a long-held belief. They just are incapable of empathy. You still see it everywhere on the internet and from bloggers. And what the research shows is that's not true. It's turned out that narcissists of all kinds, no matter how extreme, have a capacity for empathy. They can be very caring, very empathic. Again, this is where it gets confusing. But when something troubles them, they feel preoccupied with something that bothers them or their own needs become important, their empathy becomes blocked. So it's more properly understood as impaired or dysfunctional empathy. It fluctuates, you know, it vanishes. Suddenly you feel like the light was on you and then it got turned off. What you're looking for in the way of hope is somebody where when you speak to your partner in the right way, they can get how you're feeling. It can sort of switch on their empathy. So in rethinking narcissism, I don't want people to work really hard, paragraph long statements that they have to make. I break it down into two simple things. First, affirm the relationship. You know, if your husband, your partner, you're the most important person in my life, which is why I feel devastated when you criticize everything I do, when I hear this constant criticism. I love you and I care about you and I want to feel like you look up to me, and that feels so bad. I feel so sad in these moments. So first, affirm the relationship and then speak from a vulnerable place. Our tendency in bad relationships is to either shut down in silence and tiptoe around or lash out in rage. Those are the two most common patterns. And so what I do is teach people to test out some hope by learning to use these empathy prompts to see if their partner can be reached. If people are capable of empathy, they melt when they hear comments like this.
The word hope, I love that word. And I love the word dream. There's nothing wrong with dreaming. I mean, we think that dreaming is a bad thing. It's something that we can go for, but it can also get in the way. And in the conversation about narcissism, I don't know, I've read, you make mention of it, I won't say it as well as you do. Talk to me about dreaming.
Yeah.
And let's end on dreaming, because I think it's a positive.
Yes, absolutely. This is another aspect that I talk about in rethinking narcissism, the surprising good part, that we all need to feel a little special, to feel resilient, and even helps us be closer in our relationships because we view our partners through rose-colored glasses. And all of that is wrapped up in not being stuck in exactly how things are, but being able to reach for something more, whether it's a dream of becoming an artist or it's a dream of developing a new invention. When you look at people who have achieved these things, yes, there are plenty of people who feel like nothing and they feel worthless and also are able to produce. But it feels a lot better not to have that. And a lot of people, what we found in our research is that people who are high in healthy narcissism answered questions like, I like to dream big, but not at the expense of my relationships. Hmm. They were more likely to say yes to that question. And I talk about in rethinking narcissism too, the whole problem of if your message growing up, many people who struggle at the level of echoism where they have a lack of this ability to see themselves through rose-colored glasses, they were told, don't get ahead of yourself. Don't get a big head. You know, you're shooting too high. You're probably going to end up disappointed. In other words, their sense of ambition is discouraged. And it's clear, we have this, most of us, if we're not neglected as kids, kids who are, you ask a preschooler, five, or somebody five or six, who failed a test, how are they going to do on that same test tomorrow? And they'll say, great. we need a little of that, even as adults. What's interesting about that is that, you know, kids experience failure again and again and again. If they weren't able to dream, you know, if they aren't able to at least imagine that they're going to ace that test tomorrow, what a miserable experience they're going to have always expecting to fail. So I think that's one of the reasons, and it's probably almost wired into us to approach things this way. And as adults, it often helps to achieve beyond the ordinary, to at least believe that you can do something beyond ordinary long enough until you get information that tells you otherwise and you have to adjust your expectations. That was the key difference between people high in healthy narcissism and those in extreme narcissism. People high in healthy narcissism will take in information and adjust. Okay, that didn't work. I made a mistake, but I want to keep doing this. I want to try.
Fascinating conversation. Fascinating subject in this Facebook, Twitter world, which I call the neo-narcissism breeding grounds. You've written a very important book. I've been speaking with Dr. Craig Malkin, author of Rethinking Narcissism, The Bad and Surprising Good About Feeling Special, by way of Harper Wave, an imprint of HarperCollins. Be sure to view his series on Rethinking Narcissism, currently broadcasting on Oprah Winfrey's own network. Visit Dr. Malkin on his website at drcraigmalkin.com and find him on Facebook and Twitter under Dr. Craig Malkin. Thanks so much for tuning in to the Hallie Kasser-Jane Show, a production of RESAC LLC. Associate producer, Suzanne Probst. Music by Tony Rosales Jazz. Visit HallieKasserJane.com.